From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, and prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, a makeover at MySpace continues to transform Hollywood into your space. We'll chat with MySpace CEO Chris DeWolf. Plus, SAG and AFTRA's battle over the hearts, minds, and voicemail of its members. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Go nowhere. It's The Business from NPR. In the There's No Hope for the Future department, Ad Age's TV editor Brian Steinberg took note of an interesting Forrester Research report last week. It found that our consumption of video is expected to rise 25% to 5 hours per day by 2013. That's compared with the 4 hours the average American watches these days. Forrester defines video as stuff we watch on TV, but also computers, mobile phones, portable media players, and even digital photo frames. Now, worth mentioning is how much video we were watching just 2 years ago. 2.6 hours of TV alone, according to the Labor Department's American Time Use Study. Let's do some math, people. In just 7 years, we've about doubled the amount of video we watch. Assuming things continue at the rate they're going, by 2026, we'll be watching 10 hours of video a day. And if labor negotiations continue the way they've been going, actors will still only be getting about a nickel per view. But we'll get into that craziness a little later in the show. Speaking of looking to the future, Variety reports that Spike Lee will co-direct and write Time Traveler, an adaptation of a memoir by Ronald Mallett, one of the nation's first African Americans to earn a PhD in theoretical physics. Lee acquired Time Traveler, a scientist's personal mission to make time travel a reality, with his own money. But he's supposedly less interested in making a film that recounts Mallett's rise from poverty to a distinguished academic, and more interested in what Mallett calls a workable time machine, which, of course, would allow Lee to go back and not make Bamboozled. Speaking of using your time wisely, musician and producer Sean Combs, a.k.a. Puff Daddy, a.k.a. P. Diddy, a.k.a. Diddy, told The Hollywood Reporter last week that he now spends 15 to 20 days in L.A. working on becoming a thespian. Quote, "When I said I was serious about pursuing my acting career, I knew I would have to move out here. That was really hard. New York, they didn't want me to move. I'm only bi-coastal, but they're not really happy with that. New York is not really happy with me being at Laker games or being out here spending a lot of time with you guys," end quote. Reached by phone, New York had no comment. Finally, it's big news around Hollywood that Steven Spielberg, David Geffen, and Jeffrey Katzenberg have broken DreamWorks SKG free of Paramount, with $500 million from India's Reliance ADA group. The Paramount-DreamWorks marriage was never really a happy one, but the divorce could get even uglier. As Claudia Eller reported in the LA Times, quote, "In the coming weeks, DreamWorks will begin the complicated business of dissolving their bitter two-and-a-half-year union, leaving in limbo hundreds of movie projects, employees, talent, and producers who work for the company," end quote. While the town is focused on the details of their separation, we are more concerned with the following questions. Who the hell is the Reliance ADA group? Why did these three unimaginably rich and well-connected Hollywood power players have to go to Bollywood to raise money? And why were they only able to score a piddling $500 million? But most importantly, will Shrek start sounding like Deepak Chopra?
Donkey, let me explain something to you, okay? Your brain is filled with rage and anger. You should read my book. I'm okay. You're an ass.
And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up in a bit, we'll be talking to Chris DeWolf, the CEO of MySpace. The giant social networking site is undergoing a renovation that could make it even bigger with users and advertisers. But first, Hollywood's continuing, never-ending labor brouhaha. People were amazed when a war of words led the two Hollywood actors' unions to negotiate their contracts with producers separately for the first time in 27 years. There was even more amazement when AFTRA, with its reputation as kind of a weak negotiator, hung tough and came away with what was regarded as a pretty good deal. Then the last infinitesimal dewdrop of wonderment was spilled when SAG came out against the AFTRA deal with all its guns blazing. We're going to get a quick update on what's happening in the actors' negotiations with Richard Verrier. He's the Hollywood Labor Reporter for the LA Times. But first, to give you a sense of the craziness, here's a protest robocall that was sent by SAG to actors who are in both SAG and AFTRA.
Hi, this is Sandra Oh of Grey's Anatomy. As a SAG and AFTRA member, I urge you to join me in voting no on AFTRA's primetime TV contract. AFTRA's proposed deal gave up on residuals in new media and allows the studios and networks to produce some made-for-new media productions non-union. Our SAG negotiators need to fight for a fair contract for all of us, but they can only do that if we vote no on this premature deal. AFTRA's weak deal is bad for all actors. So remember, when your ballot arrives, please vote no to AFTRA's deal and mail it in today. Thanks so much.
So, Richard, what do you make of that? Can they, first of all, do you think, torpedo AFTRA's deal?
I think it's possible. Clearly, they feel it's possible. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing it. I think it's, most people would say it's a tall order. I mean, it's typically, in most unions, the membership tends to vote in support of their leadership, their elected leadership. And it would be pretty unusual for the members to reject a contract that their leaders negotiated.
These are clearly thespians who are going to have to deal with each other again. And it just seems as though, I wonder, I'll ask you, do you think that they can work together again?
It's hard to see how that would occur given all the statements, vitriolic statements that have been made about the leadership, and that was basically why they didn't decide to negotiate jointly to begin with. You know, unless there's a change in the leaderships of the unions, you know, there is an election coming up at SAG, and, you know, unless there's a change of position, I don't see how these two unions can get back together anytime soon.
So 17 years of joint negotiations down the toilet.
At least for now, it looks that way.
Now there's also talk of a possible studio lockout. So what's that about?
The actor's contract expires June 30th. And if they can't reach an agreement by the end of the month, the studios could basically essentially force SAG to go on strike, and the actors would be working without a contract. The problem with that strategy is that the studios would essentially be hurting themselves because they have obviously a number of TV shows that are just gearing back up for production after the writer's strike, and a lot of those, you know, the whole television industry was really battered by the writer's strike, the 100-day writer's strike. So an actor's strike would shut down, you know, major studio feature films.
Well, in some respects, it already has.
Because it already has. Yeah.
I think most studios have agreed they don't want to be out there having to mothball a $100 or $200 million picture in the middle of a strike.
They stopped greenlighting most major films, and already, you know, months ago had changed their schedule so that most films would wrap by June 30th. There are some films that are kind of caught in between, you know, that will be affected by strike, but then there are others that they're planning further down the road that would be held up by an actor strike. So I think it'd be a very risky strategy for them to force a lockout. It would also be possibly, you know, could backfire on them as a PR move. You know, they would be blamed for forcing a costly strike. On the other hand, the studios probably wouldn't want to wait months and months to reach an agreement with the actors. They would want some resolution because they do have so many projects that are hanging in the balance.
So what about a strike? I mean, do you think that the leadership of SAG has sufficiently riled up its membership, most of which doesn't usually work anyway and wouldn't necessarily mind going out on strike, to the point where they're so lathered up that the only thing that they will accept is gains in the one area that the studios have said absolutely, positively, no way are you getting a penny more on this DVD area?
I think it would be difficult for the union right now if they were to go out and get a strike authorization vote from their members. It might be difficult for them to get that. They would need 75% of the voting members to prove that. Just because there is a lot of weariness about another strike, and a lot of actors were affected, of course, by the writer's strike. You're right that that SAG's membership is made up of folks who don't act full-time for a living, and perhaps they might be more inclined to support a walkout. But I think the prevailing view is that it'd be difficult for SAG to get support for a strike at this point. but it's not an absolutely clear-cut situation.
We only have a few moments left, so I want to hopefully get your thoughts on what the end game is here. So let's assume that it's impossible or very difficult to get a strike authorization at the Screen Actors Guild. So the tactic then is, well, we'll try and scuttle the AFTRA deal. So if that deal goes south, if it's such a poisonous environment, how can they possibly then go back to the table and ask AFTRA to get the things that they so desperately want?
You mean if they do succeed in defeating the AFTRA contract?
Correct.
I think they're counting on if they're successful in that effort, and there might be people who might be inclined to support SAG in its criticism of AFTRA who may not necessarily support a strike. Those are two different things. And so SAG might think that if they can successfully overturn the AFTRA agreement, or at least persuade these 44,000 members to vote it down, that would, you know, bolster their arguments with the studios, and that they would be in a stronger negotiating position. But it's not exactly clear how these two unions, you know, would come together after such a bitter fight. So that's kind of an unknown.
Last question. Do you think we're going to have a strike?
It's a tough call. I'd say it's 50-50. My guess is probably not, that there will probably be a period of an extended period of time where the actors will work without a contract. But I don't think it'll necessarily come to a strike. But I can't say that with any high degree of certainty.
Richard Verrier is the lead entertainment labor reporter for the L.A. Times. He joined us from his office there in downtown L.A. Richard, thanks for being on The Business.
Thanks very much.
In 2003, MySpace was launched primarily as a way for bands and their fans to share music. It billed itself, in fact, as a place for music. The site quickly became the de rigueur online meeting place for younger folks everywhere, and the 100 millionth account was created just 3 years later. In the interim, the site was bought for the then astonishing but now bargain sum of $580 million by Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, the parent company of Fox. Today, MySpace has become the calling card for an entire generation, and it now bills itself as a place for friends. But it continues to underperform when it comes to revenue. In fact, it recently missed its earnings target by 10%. That's a $100 million miss. But they aim to change that. The site has always been a little messy, like a teenager's bedroom. Last week, MySpace announced it's getting a makeover to declutter the site and make way for new advertising. There are new features for users, including a built-in video player called MySpace TV. It also rolled out a new initiative that would make it easier for local advertisers to reach people in their area, with coupons and other blandishments. We went to the offices of Fox Interactive in Beverly Hills to talk to Chris DeWolf, the CEO of MySpace, about the future of the world's largest social networking site and what else it might still become. Chris DeWolf, welcome to The Business.
Hey, Claude. Thanks for having me.
If I'm a local TV station, if I'm a local newspaper, local radio station, I'm terrified. I mean, this would seem to be, if it works, a disaster if you're a local newspaper or a local radio station, right? I mean, you have demographic, psychographic information on basically a population that is just a cat's breath smaller than Japan. And if I wanted that information delivered to me in a way that I can use it, that makes sense, like I only want to get my coupons to the people who live near my dry cleaner, that's far more efficient than just blasting out an ad through AM radio or through TV or a newspaper, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't think radio or TV or newspapers are really going away, but I do selfishly believe that, you know, the MySpace hyper-targeted advertising, you know, where we can target that particular zip code, is the most effective and efficient form of advertising out there. But, you know, again, I think we're driving more people to listen to the radio show. They're not going to be on MySpace while they're driving, but they're going to be listening to the radio while they're driving. So again, I believe the two mediums can be synergistic.
Do you believe it's a zero-sum game? That is, there's a finite amount of advertising dollars out there, and that if they're spending it with you guys, they're not spending it elsewhere?
I think clearly, you know, you can take a look at the numbers and see that, you know, the internet display advertising business is increasing by 25% over the next 12 months. and other mediums are either flat or slightly decreasing. So, you know, I think from that perspective, you know, certainly the internet's growing quite a bit faster than other mediums.
But not necessarily at the expense of other mediums, for now.
It depends on the industry. In some industries, certainly anything that's direct response oriented is spending more and more money online. Some of the big brands are still throwing a disproportionately high percentage of their media dollars at TV, but we're seeing that switch over the next 12 months.
So MySpace is going to become far more relevant to advertisers. It's going to become more relevant to their customers because they're going to be getting advertising that matters to them, that they can actually use.
Correct.
Now, here's the question. In terms of entertainment conglomerates, if I can find everything else on MySpace, that means ostensibly less time spent listening to the radio for music, watching TV, if I can get the shows on MySpace, going to movies. If I'm doing all those other things, I may not go to the movies as much. Should media companies fear you, emulate you, or get into bed with you?
I think we've done a pretty good job in working in partnership with the other media companies. I think everything you said is right on. People are spending less time watching TV. They're spending more time on the internet, and I think they're also spending more time playing games like Guitar Hero. But what I think a lot of the TV networks are realizing is that, you know, they're great at making content. Internet companies aren't great at making content, but internet company can be a viable distributor of content, and there is definitely a monetization stream that's being developed. So I think as you see the internet becoming more personal, meaning if I'm a user, I'm consuming content where I want it and how I want it and when I want it, and I'm sharing it with whoever I want, as opposed to going to, you know, NBC.com or ABC.com or Fox.com to find my content. I'm finding it when my friend sends me a note or I'm looking at my friend updates on MySpace and it says, my friend Danny just uploaded a new video, and that's how I discover it.
So you mentioned Fox,
right,
which of course MySpace is owned by News Corporation, which
correct,
of course also owns Fox. How do you serve both your current corporate masters, which is News Corporation, which owns a film studio and a television network, and become the portal you want to be at the same time, you know, that basically is a one-stop shopping for entertainment? Isn't it to News Corporation's advantage to agree that all animals are equal, but that some are a little more equal than others, and that the advantage, you know, that if the tie goes, the tie shouldn't go to the runner, tie should go to Fox programming, that it should go to Fox movies, that it should, you know, it's a tough opening weekend. You know, Chris, I think we can agree that maybe that Warner Brothers ad, maybe it just, the insertion order got lost. you know what I'm saying here? Is there...
So I think there's a couple things. Number one, I think when you're looking at anything from a television perspective, whether that means clips or full episodes online and how they get viewed, it's not really up to a network to dictate how a user is going to consume that content. It's, you know, the genie's out of the bottle, and that's why it's coming on MySpace. That's why it's being shared on MySpace. We're just trying to do it in a way where the people that have funded the content and the people that have worked so hard on creating that art can get paid for their art as it gets viewed online. You know, and certainly from a financial perspective, we have really aggressive goals here at MySpace, and we're going to treat everyone equally.
Coming up after a short break, more with Chris DeWolf, the CEO of MySpace. You're listening to The Business from NPR. Listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. MySpace has become the world's largest social networking site, but it's not clear if it's through its awkward pubescence. Unlike the clean look of similar sites like Facebook, MySpace has always been messy, kind of like a teenager's bedroom. But last week, they decided to clean their room a bit with a redesign. Actually, more like a decluttering. So now, newspapers, radio, and television stations, and anyone else that sells advertising, has real cause to worry, because there's plenty of space for ads on MySpace. And with people spending more and more time on sites like MySpace and other social networks, they very much are the newest competition for the studios and the TV networks. We're at the offices of MySpace in Beverly Hills and talking to the CEO, Chris DeWolf. So is there anything that the movie studios, the TV networks, the record labels, even the electronics manufacturers are doing to sort of, or not doing, to play into your hands? Is there something that they don't get?
Well, you know, I think it's taking a very long time, but as you may or may not know, we just announced a really groundbreaking great joint venture with the largest music companies in the world. So Universal Music, Warner Music.
Well, three of the four anyway.
Sony, yeah, and Sony BMG, you know, we've signed deals with. And so right now, when you go to an artist page on MySpace, you'll get four or five songs you'll be able to listen to. You'll be able to see the tour dates. But what this deal does now is it gives us the whole library of content. So if I go to Bruce Springsteen's page on MySpace, I can listen to one of his latest songs, but then I can also go back and listen to the whole album of The River. I can create a playlist for free. I can share it with my friends for free. And I can stream anything I want for free. So the idea is that MySpace Music will become the central hub for that artist and anything that's musically related to that artist. And that's never been done before. And what's really interesting about this is we're creating revenue streams around this that make sense for not only the music companies, but for the artists too, so everyone gets paid.
How important is it to the MySpace business model for a MySpacer or MySpace cadet or whatever they whatever the rank is of a MySpace user to buy stuff?
I think e-commerce is definitely a viable revenue stream for us in the future. It's a big part of our music joint venture and creating this context to allow people to listen to music for free online. But then, you know, as they find a playlist from one of their friends that they really enjoy, to make it really easy for them to buy that. If I'm on an artist page, I want to be able to see when that artist is going to be coming to town. I want to be able to buy a ticket directly from that page. I want to be able to buy a ringtone, a t-shirt, a mug, whatever it may be. So the idea is that you now take five or six different revenue streams as opposed to the one revenue stream before that, and these five or six revenue streams are really what create the business. So in the past, the music labels have relied on selling CDs. CD sales are down by 15 to 20%. And they create these amazing brands and aren't able to capitalize on the other revenue opportunities. And what we're doing is we're providing an opportunity for them to capitalize on those other revenue opportunities.
Why not do that in television or film? I mean, the same model that you're using for record companies, it seems like a natural for television or film.
Well, I think it's happening. I think you're seeing that with television for sure. I think film, it's a little bit awkward because people don't want to sit in front of their PCs for 2 hours watching a film. They want to watch 2 to 5 minute sound bites. And so it works for, you know, the hook in the television show The Office, or maybe even an entire episode of The Office at maybe 22 minutes, or certain episodes or certain parts of Saturday Night Live. It works really well. And we're doing that right now. We're doing that with Fox. We're doing that with BBC. We're doing that with NBC. So I think you're seeing that happening already.
Is the logical extension of that not just distribution deals with these content companies like the BBC or NBC or any other BC, but also to make it, again, talking about relevance to the consumer, not just giving them the entertainment they want, but also the commerce that they want, so to speak. So if I like the blouse that Jennifer Fisher is wearing on The Office, or if I like the shoes on Sex and the City, or if I see a jacket on Steve Carell that I want, why can't I just click on something and, you know...
I think that's possibly viable, but I think that whenever you're looking at a business model, you have to make sure it's scalable. So then, you know, for every single episode, you're looking at getting inventory for, you know, every single one of those outfits. And the analogy or comparison to music is very different because a substantially higher percentage of money coming out of the music industry, you know, is coming from touring and coming from merchandise, especially as it relates to the artist. So I think the e-commerce opportunity in something television-related is much smaller than, or comparatively smaller than in music.
I guess it could be, but I mean, you know, you talk about product integration. It's like the hot
right.
word in Hollywood right,
right
now. But it seems like there's the sense I get from talking to ad guys who do this for a living. You say, how do you know you're doing well? How do you know you're succeeding? Like, well, we put the Oreo into Seventh Heaven. It's like, well, so how many more Oreos did you sell? Well, we don't know, but we think it went really well, you know?
And mm-hmm.
so why not then, you know, if the interactivity of the web is the thing that makes it so vastly expandable in terms of other opportunities, there's, you know, why not have pop-up video when you watch a show on MySpace as opposed to when you watch it on NBC? And it says, by the way, this blouse, $29.95 at jcrew.com.
Yeah,
get it right now.
You know, I think that's completely viable, and I think it's viable for any sponsor, and it doesn't necessarily have to be someone's blouse or something they're wearing, but, you know, it may be Coke may be the product integration sponsor, or, you know, Nissan may be the product integration sponsor. You know, it happens all the time, and the great thing about the internet is it is extremely measurable, and as I mentioned earlier, we're also offering a package that allows a product integration partner or an advertiser to be able to actually see who's clicking on ads. So I can get a hyper-targeted report back saying horror movie enthusiasts are clicking on my ads and action sports enthusiasts are clicking on my ads and soccer moms in the Middle West are clicking on my ads. So I think that provides a lot of amazing opportunities for advertisers that don't exist in other mediums.
You seem like a very laid-back guy, not prone to pounding tables or anything like that. But in your Orson Welles, Citizen Kane fever dream, what would MySpace become?
So, you know, from the early days, we always wanted to be the largest site in the world on the internet that is, you know, connecting multiple countries and, you know, multiple religions and people with multiple ideologies. And I think we're getting there. We're the largest social network in the world. We're officially in 29 different countries, and there's people virtually throughout the whole globe using MySpace. You know, we see a huge advance in the in people taking MySpace with them and using it on their mobile devices. So we're going to continue to grow globally, and we're going to continue to port MySpace to mobile devices. And, you know, in a perfect world, you know, we hope it changes how people communicate.
Well, Chris DeWolf, I really appreciate the time, and thanks for doing the business.
Thanks for having me, Claude.
And that's the business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
If God had a MySpace, what would it be like? Would he add me as a friend? And if not, does that mean I'm going to hell? What would you post if you had just one cup?